Hey, everybody. Good evening. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. How you doing? Did you have a good day? Don't answer. Yeah, me too. Welcome to the show. It's about 7 past the hour. You getting ready for Christmas? Are you? With all the uncertainty and craziness this year, and certainly the drop in income and people losing savings and 401ks and this and that, maybe the idea of the winter solstice celebration could kind of slip back in, you think? Even mix it up a little bit with the Christian celebration and put the two of them together. You know, have people get together for parties and have a big fire in the fireplace if you have one. If you don't, big fire in the backyard. If you don't have that, up on the roof of your building. If you don't have that, in your bathtub, you know, whatever. Put up holly and make a hot mulled wine. If you don't have money for that, ask somebody to bring it over, you know, and get together, tell stories, sing songs, play games with the kids, you know, that sort of thing. The way America has been, the United States has been celebrating Christmas the past, I don't know, about 20 years has really been a stomach turner, hasn't it? Which is not to say that I haven't done my share to participate in that over the years. But little by little, it got more and more difficult for me and finally just damn near impossible to continue that nonsense. I don't know. You know, I'm not trying to go all goofy on you here. I mean, a lot of people see this as the celebration of the birth of the Prince of Peace. How's it working out, by the way? Spreading the gospel of the Prince of Peace around the earth. It doesn't seem to have been working out very well at all over the past 2,000 years. Maybe it's the wrong guy. You know, maybe somebody else had a better message. Who knows? Or maybe the messengers. I don't know. But if you kind of eliminate that and go back to what the winter solstice celebration was all about, which also was based on fear and superstition, you know. Oh, my God, the sun's leaving! Build bonfires, it'll come back! and I guess that kind of evolved into, okay, it's not really leaving. Let's just get together, though, because it's colder than hell out there and dark. And, you know, Grendel might be wandering around in the birches. So come on in. Let's drink the mead or the mulled wine and build a fire and tell stories and sing songs. Deck the halls with boughs of holly. Which is really a joyful old Celtic Welsh song, isn't it? Don't you love that song, Deck the Halls? So I don't know. I've been thinking about that because I have grown children who are struggling with their finances. Two of them are parents, and they really looked forward this year to the gifts that came from Dad, that's me, for their children. I have another son who's in university, so is his wife, and they're students. There's not a whole lot they can do. So they're going to spend Christmas with Katie's parents, that's my son Chris's wife, and Kathy and I are going to just mount up the day after Christmas and go down to Florida, where I have two daughters and grandchildren. We're going to hang out down there with Molly. But there's so much more fun to have than just, you know, going to the mall and fighting all that stuff. And everybody talks about that, but maybe this year, out of necessity, there'll be a little less focus on the craziness of it. Let's see, I've gone so far 5 minutes into this without saying materialism. Oh, I'll go ahead and say it. You know, maybe this year, less emphasis on the material and more emphasis on the spiritual, whichever side of the spiritual coin you decide to go. If you decide to go with the ancient old religion, fine. If you decide to go with Christianity, the real Christianity, fine. If you decide to go with the Celtic mythology, fine. You know, whatever. Huh? What do you think? No? Bad idea? All right. Well, I just thought I'd toss it out. You can toss it back in. Speaking of Christmas gifts, ABC News is reporting that Chrysler has announced at the end of Friday shift, day after tomorrow, all manufacturing facilities will be closed until middle, end of January 2009. Now, I would assume they mean all. Chrysler has manufacturing facilities in other countries, don't they? I'm not sure. But we certainly know that all 30 facilities in North America will close temporarily. That would be the United States and Canada. The Ford plant in Windsor, Ontario, Canada, which makes minivans, and the assembly plant in Detroit, which makes builds engines and Vipers, will close through the entire month of January. The two Chrysler plants in my hometown of Toledo will be shut down through nearly the entire month of January. That means 46,000 UAW workers will be not working starting this Friday until, in some instances, the end of January. What is that, 6 weeks? Chrysler says these particular employees will receive the usual state unemployment benefits. That's assuming the states have the money, as well as supplemental payments from Chrysler, whatever that means, during the layoff. That's according to a formula negotiated by the UAW. Okay. Now, the news also includes the fact that the workers will not be receiving their regular income. Well, certainly. It'll be unemployment compensation and supplemental payments from Chrysler. There will also be a large number of white-collar workers who will not be working as well, but they will continue to receive their regular salaries during this time. Oh, ouch! Wait a minute. Really? The men and women who work in the factories will get a slap in the face, a kick in the ass, and a handout from Chrysler, an unemployment comp from the states if it's available. But the white-collar workers won't be affected where it concerns their salaries? Well, gosh darn, that's pretty weird. It's pretty expected, but it's pretty weird. Now, as for the number of cars and trucks not being built, Chrysler, which, of course, is a privately held company, which wants billions of our tax dollars, but Chrysler will not disclose how many cars and trucks will not be built in those 6 weeks. It'll be several tens of thousands, you can be sure. Well, that'll clear the roads, won't it? Now, the company, Chrysler, the privately owned company, says their dealers out on the street are telling them there are buyers out there. But the car dealers are saying they can't get financing. And as a result, have lost 20 to 25% of their sales. The dealerships can't get financing from credit corporations or banks or lending institutions or whatever. One bankruptcy expert predicted that while the freaks in the Republican freaks in the Senate tinker with how much aid to provide and under what conditions, the auto companies will continue to play what is starting to look like a game of chicken between the owners, you know, management of these auto companies and the Republican thugs who want to see it all go down. Isn't this fun?
did thou's appalling. Fa la 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 la. 'Tis the season to be jolly. Fa la 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 la. Don we now our gay apparel.
You're listening to Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. Turn down your speakers, it'll be our secret.
La, 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 la.
21 past the hour. Bernard Madoff, Madoff, is that his first name? Madoff? Bernard is his first name, Mike. Madoff is his last name. Mr. Madoff, who apparently has, if you believe the media, has run the biggest Ponzi scheme in the history of Ponzi schemes, $50 billion. I hate to say this. I'm embarrassed to say it, but I'll say it anyway. I almost get a gleeful feeling, except for the charities. I almost get a gleeful feeling to see the unimaginably wealthy ripping off the unimaginably wealthy. You know, sharks eating sharks. It's beyond Schadenfreude. It's into a whole different universe of weird feelings for me, because you know you don't really want to wish bad things to happen to other people or celebrate when they do. Although the Buddhist approach, of course, is to stand back and observe and just say, how about that? Well, what do you know? Of course, that's the approach if you see children being devoured by bears, too. So, but there's something about the Madoff scandal that is just almost invigorating. I'm sorry. I shouldn't admit to that sort of incorrect thinking. But it's there. Now, the thing that after I get past that, then I think, okay, where was the Security and Exchange Commission, the SEC, that was set up specifically to rescue Wall Street from itself decades ago? That was another one of the Roosevelt ideas, if I'm not mistaken. Where was the SEC? Well, the SEC was in the firm control of this absolutely useless former representative from California, Christopher Cox. Do you remember him? He appointed or nominated and confirmed, I think it takes confirmation, maybe not, back in August of 2005. He's a Republican, of course, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Southern California from 1989 to 2005. And he resigned from Congress to become chairman of the SEC. And if I remember, he was one of the people that was so pleased with and excited about the impeachment of Bill Clinton. For whatever reason, it didn't make any difference. I mean, it could have been treason. It could have been lying about getting a little oral sex from his girlfriend. Didn't matter. Christopher Cox was right there. But if you remember, if you can get in the Wayback Machine, go back about 10 years to when the assault on Clinton actually became, or actually started, you'll remember Cox with kind of a smarmy, half-informed, idiotic look on his face while he took up the cudgel of moral indignation, went after Bill Clinton. And then somehow he got himself appointed. It was a payback, I guess, a payoff. Cox used to work for Reagan, I think. A payoff to Christopher Cox for being a good little proto-fascist here in post-democratic United States. So he got to be the head of the SEC. And one of the reasons I think he got to be head of SEC is because he is a complete dumbass. This is a guy that doesn't have the sense to come in out of the rain. I mean, a complete blithering idiot. What is it about Southern California that sends these people to Congress over and over and over, like Duke Cunningham, who, while he had his own troubles, had a son who was trying to smuggle coke into the country? I mean, what is it about Orange County and San Diego County? What is up with you people? How did these? Oh, never mind. Different story, different topic. But here's Christopher Cox, who was appointed the head of SEC specifically, like everyone else who got an appointment for anything during the Bush Crime Families Salad Days. His job, Christopher Cox's, was to put his hands over his ears, stuff chewing gum over his eyes, and go, la, 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 whenever someone said, Chris, there seems to be some real ugly stuff going on over here. La, 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 la. Well, he did his job very well. So now Christopher Cox is declaiming all sorts of things about the need for regulatory oversight, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, like so many Bush crime family soldiers, the civilian ones, Christopher Cox is the problem. As far as normal Americans are concerned, he's the problem. As far as the Bush crime family and Cheney and the rest of these rat bastards, Christopher Cox did exactly what he was supposed to do. He was supposed to cover his ears and shut his eyes and go, la, 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 I can't hear you, la, 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 whenever somebody said, you're the head of the SEC. Shouldn't you be SEC-ing today? I mean, is there anything that you should be looking at? La 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 la.
The searchlight in the big yard swings round with the gun and spotlights, snowflakes like the dust in the sun. It's Christmas in prison. There'll be music tonight. I'll probably get homesick. I'll love you. Good night. Wait a while.
The next best thing to an impeachment hearing, it's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
It's about 25 before the hour. Got an email here during the break with some bad news in it. Our good friend Maddie Joan has died in her sleep 5 or 6 days ago in New York. Maddie Joan was in the Pokemon movies. She was a cartoon voice on a lot of the cartoon channels. And she also used to call the program. She was Smeagol. You remember? Remember when Smeagol would call? God, those were some good vocal impersonations. She also called in Zan Coulter occasionally. And even George Bush. Even did Bush. She had a whole pantheon of characters. Maddie Joan, I believe, was probably about 40, 41 years old. And while she died very, very young, there is always the belief that someone who passes away in their sleep must have led a righteous life. Last time we saw Maddie Joan was the last time we were in the city, in New York City, and went to lunch as we did with Maddie Joan every time we went up there. Has it been that long? Almost 2 years ago. So anyway, for those of you who remember the characters that Maddie used to do, because we never talked about the characters on the air, it was just Smeagol calling in. Maddie Joan has stepped off this earthly coil. Now, see, I was screaming a moment ago, rest in peace, Maddie Joan, a moment ago about Mr. Madoff and Christopher Cox and the Securities and Exchange Commission. And how everyone is shocked, I tell you, that there's gambling going on in Rick's place. Just absolutely shocked. You must be kidding. There is gambling here? Oh, how could this be? Absolutely shocking, isn't it, that the Securities and Exchange, just like it was absolutely shocking, wasn't it, that Arthur Andersen, remember them? Prestigious, 2-million-year-old accounting firm, you know, everybody, blah, 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 Arthur Andersen, wow! But somehow they got enmeshed in the Enron, as a matter of fact, enmeshed, they helped engineer the Enron ripoff. And on and on and on. So the SEC, whose job it is to make sure that there's no fraud, because so much of what happened in the 20s and 30s that led to the stock market crash in 1929 and the subsequent chaos in American financial markets and ultimately World War II. Of course, that had its roots in World War I, but the SEC was chartered to make sure that this sort of thing didn't happen again. That if somebody said 2 plus 2 is 4, it really was 4. So Christopher Cox, the latest in the Bush crime family scoundrel, who did his job exactly as the Bush crime family wanted him to do his job, is now whining and wetting his pants and looking rather sheepish about the Madoff $50 billion and counting ripoff. You got to wonder where the money went, right? The $50 billion, of course, is on paper. Nobody really put in $50 billion. They put in $3 million, a billion, $4 billion, $5 billion, $10 billion, half a million, $17 million, you know, whatever. And Madoff, of course, had the perfect scam. You had to beat on his door for years in order to have him take your money. That's always the best way to do it. That's the Tom Sawyer help me. Don't help me paint the picket fence here. Or not the picket fence, but the fence. Don't help me because I am having too much fun. Go away. But Tom, go away. But Tom, here's a bag of candy. Well, all right, you can paint a little bit. That's what Madoff did. Exactly. The Tom Sawyer scam, and he did it very, 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 very well. But the bulldog that was supposed to be sitting there, ready to bark and yelp and notify everybody, cheat, look, cheat, cheat. Christopher Cox is too damn stupid, and venal, and a thug, and part of the Bush crime family. It's amazing, isn't it? It does not stop. We have found out over the past 8 years, in bits and pieces and chunks, as we can, how much damage these sons of bitches have done to this country, the Bush crime family. And we are going to continue to find out. They're still doing it. It doesn't make any difference that Bush and Cheney and the rest of these rat bastards are gone. They continue to do it, and they will do it. I mean, Bush has already started another war, hasn't he? Didn't he order U.S. troops into Somalia or something? Nobody's talking about that very much, are they? Oh, that's right, we're chasing pirates. No, we decided not to chase pirates, whatever. But we're going to continue to find out the damage, the essential damage, the damage they've done to the underpinnings of this country, the essence of this country, for months, if not years. This is astounding what they have done. What we have done. Because once it became clear, way back in 2003, that George W. Bush felt that he could step outside of recognized law and attack a helpless country based on lies. Once we realized that, we did nothing. So it's with our complicity that all this has happened, up to and including Christopher Cox. But it's just weird to me anyway to see people like Cox wringing their hands and whining and bitching when it was, they did it. Let's take Rachel's program live because Carl Levin is talking about an investigation of Bush and Cheney. Let's listen.
Is that President Bush and Vice President Cheney have essentially argued that they have legalized waterboarding, that they have legalized torture. They think that the actions of their Justice Department made things like waterboarding not war crimes anymore. Are they right?
You can't just suddenly change something that's illegal into something that is legal by having a lawyer write an opinion saying that it's legal. Things can't work that way, or else someone could get a lawyer to say a crime is not a crime, and then that would be a defense. It is not a defense, I was astounded, frankly, when I heard the Vice President of the United States sort of just blandly and blithely saying that, oh, he thought that was an appropriate thing, and yes, he was involved in the discussions about it.
Do there need to be prosecutions? You document very clearly that we have eroded the standards by which prisoners are treated in the United States. How do we unerode those standards if the people who authorized the erosion of those standards are essentially immunized from prosecution?
Well, the first thing we have to do is what we did, at least for the Department of Defense, is to bring to light the facts. What happened here? What was the origin of the use of these techniques? And that's what we did. We went back to Guantanamo and showed that, as a matter of fact, that the highest levels of this government, the president, when he said that the Geneva Convention did not apply, then the Secretary of Defense, when he authorized the use of aggressive techniques, and then the way they spread it first into Afghanistan, then to Iraq, this is the first step on reconstructing the respect of the world for this country. And I'm hopeful that the Obama administration will be taking major steps in that direction. We need to have the support of the world in our effort against terrorists.
Senator, I do want to press you a little bit on that point about the next steps and what the Obama administration might do. It sounds to me, as a layman and a concerned citizen in this, it seems to me like when you are assembling these facts and getting access to these documents and putting together this testimony, what you are doing is collecting the facts for an indictment. I know that that's not the role of the Senate Armed Services Committee, but that's what it feels like. Do you think there will be prosecutions, and will you argue that there should be?
What I think it is our role to do is to bring out the facts, which we have, to state our conclusions, which we have, which is where the origin of these techniques began, and then to turn over to the Justice Department of the next administration, because clearly this Justice Department is not willing to take an objective look, to turn over to the next Justice Department all the facts that we can and we have put together, and get our report, the rest of it, declassified. But then it seems to me it is appropriate that there be an outside commission appointed to take this out of politics, that would have the clear subpoena authority.
Carl Levin on Rachel Maddow's program on MSNBC, happening right now. Levin is talking about a report put together by the Senate Armed Services Committee, and the shocking details, I guess, to the senators that Bush and Cheney authorized torture. It is not shocking to you, gentle listener, and it's not shocking to me. We have known this for how long? How long have we known this? I mean, why is it that we seem to figure this stuff out, and the members of the House and or the Senate are always just shocked? Shocked, I tell you. But what Levin, as Rachel just pointed out, what Levin seems to be doing is building a possible case for indictments. Wouldn't that be American?
Are you perfectly comfortable going to war with a moral sanction against the law? Are you perfectly comfortable fighting the world? If you're perfectly comfortable with all that's been done, gaze at your daughters and gaze at your sons. Ask yourself this question. Over again, would you be perfectly happy if it happened to them? If you're perfectly calm.
Reality Radio for a Rational World. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
It's about 10 before the hour. Jeffrey Goldberg, who blogs at theatlantic.com, as in the Atlantic, the magazine, had something out interesting, very, very interesting, yesterday. What's the day today? 17th? Yeah, yesterday came out. Yesterday afternoon, Jeffrey writes, I just picked up Patrick Tyler's forthcoming book, A World of Trouble, about America's tortured relations with the Middle East. No, pun intended there, I'm sure. And the prologue contains this whopper of a scene, one that is quite devastating if true. An enraged George Tenet. You remember him, the head of the CIA? An enraged George Tenet, drunk on scotch, flailing about Prince Bandar's Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, pool, screaming about the Bush administration officials who were just then trying to pin the Iraq weapons of mass destruction fiasco on him. This is what it says in the book. A servant appeared with a bottle. Tenet knocked back some of the scotch, then some more. They watched with concern. He drained half the bottle in a few minutes. They're setting me up, he screamed. The bastards are setting me up, but I'm not going to take the hit. And then he said this, or and then this is in the book, in the prologue. According to one witness, he, Tenet, mocked the neoconservatives in the Bush administration and their alignment with the right wing of Israel's political establishment, referring to them with exasperation as the Jews. Patrick Tyler reports in a footnote that when asked, Tenet initially denied staying at Prince Bandar's palace, then denied that he had said anything in the pool. Tyler reports, quote, he disputed the remarks attributed to him and denied that his memory might have been affected by the amount of alcohol he was reported to have consumed on top of sleeping pills, end quote. And Jeffrey adds, I'll ask around about this and post any responses I get. I'll go with it. I'll stay with it. Sure, why not? Why not? As you know, the Obama inauguration, the presidential inauguration festivities are being put together for January 20th. As usual, Aretha Franklin is going to sing. What is up with Aretha Franklin? I mean, is she just automatically the one who sings at White House events? And what does that mean when Aretha Franklin is always tapped to sing? But they're going to have an invocation, as they do, for these sorts of events. Separation of church and state be damned. Only this time, apparently, President-elect Obama is really going to stick his thumb in the eye of just about everybody in this country who is not a snake-handling, lying, Sarah Palin-style, right-wing, evangelical, Armageddonist, let's get the rapture happening Christian, because he has asked the Reverend Rick Warren of Saddleback Church to deliver the invocation. This is astonishing. You know, there's being disappointed and there's being profoundly disappointed about something. People of the American Way is profoundly disappointed that Rick Warren will give the invocation. Mike Malloy, who hosts a radio program on Nova M, is looking for things to break and smash, and in a fit of rage about this, too. Rick Warren, who somehow picked up a reputation as being a Christian moderate, he is no more moderate than Jerry Falwell or James Dobson or Pat Robertson. He is what he is. He's got this kind of, hey, all shucks, I wear blue jeans and I'm a preacher personality. And his church's engagement on issues like AIDS in Africa is debatable. Anyone who acknowledges that there is a disease or a syndrome that needs to be the cures for which need to be funded, the pills need to be gotten out, to hell with the pharmaceutical companies, that's a good thing. But if in the prevention aspect of AIDS, people like Rick Warren say, oh, no, don't use condoms. No, 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 no. It's So that's it gets mixed reviews from me on that anyway. But he has said that the real difference between James Dobson and himself is one of tone rather than substance. He recently compared marriage by loving and committed same-sex couples. He compares that to incest and pedophilia. Yeah, he does. He has repeated the religious right's big lie that supporters of equality for Americans who happen to be gay, that those Americans are out to silence pastors. God damn you, Rick Warren, you phony. He has called Christians who advance a social gospel Marxists. He is adamantly opposed to a woman having a cone of privacy when she sits down with her obstetrician and decides whether or not to terminate a pregnancy. And it goes on and on here. I'll have some more after the break. But Rick Warren is going to give the religious claptrap mumbo-jumbo at Barack Obama's inauguration. Rick Warren, the one who tried everything he could to embarrass and put down Barack Obama when Obama showed up out there with McCain. Remember that? Oh, man. We'll be back after the break. This is Nova M. I'm Mike Molloy. Welcome back to the Molloy program on the Nova M Radio Network. Quick email here from our military affairs correspondent who says that, Rick Warren will be doing the invocation, but the benediction at the end of the event will be spoken by the Reverend Joseph Lowry of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference here in Atlanta. Someone we've known for a number of years, because you don't live in Atlanta without getting to know folks like Joseph Lowry. Joseph Lowry is a supporter of same-sex marriage. And the blogger who wrote this said, I can't read the administration's mind, but my guess here is that they, being the Obama transition team, they're crafting an inaugural meant to appeal to voters who voted against Obama as well as the supporters. But they certainly could have achieved that same bridge-building gesture by inviting a conservative evangelical who has not recently affirmed the biblical validity of assassinating the president of Iran, which Rick Warren has. Don't you just love those Christians, huh? Oh, you just love, huh? Yeah, let's go kill the head of state, some head of state. Why? What has Iran done to the United States? Well, actually, nothing. We've done things to Iran. We overthrew their government in 1953 and put the Shah of Iran in, or the Shah Pahlavi in. And then we help him set up a torture organization called SAVAK, the secret police. And how many Iranians were brutally butchered and disappeared because the United States said get rid of them? And yet here's Rick Warren, supposedly a man of Christ, saying that it's biblically acceptable in this sick son of a bitch's mind to go assassinate Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Why? What has Ahmadinejad done? Oh, never mind. Who cares? Like Gandhi said, I like your Christ. I'm not so sure about your Christians. Back to the People for the American Way. press release, they say that they're sure Warren supporters, Rick Warren supporters, will portray his selection as an appeal to unity by a president who's committed to reaching across traditional divides. But the sad truth is this decision to put this thug up there further elevates someone who in recent weeks has actively promoted legalized discrimination and denigrated the lives and relationships of millions of Americans. This is a guy who compares same-sex marriage to incest and pedophilia, worked his bony or his well-padded ass off to make sure that Prop 8 passed in California. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. In 2004, Rick Warren declared that marriage, reproductive choice, and stem cell research were all non-negotiable issues that Christian voters should stay completely away from. Same-sex marriage, reproductive choice, and stem cell research. He criticized the answers that Obama gave at that incorrectly named faith forum. Remember that? That he hosted before the election? And Rick Warren has vowed to continue to pressure Barack Obama to change his views on the issue of reproductive choice. He has declared that those who do not believe in his God should not be allowed to hold public office. How about that? He came out strongly in support of Prop 8, saying, quote, "There is no need to change the universal historical definition of marriage to appease 2% of our population. This is not a political issue. It is a moral issue that God has spoken clearly about." Really? Really, Rick? You've heard God talk about that, huh? Change the universal definition of marriage? Who wants to change it, Rick? All the people who advocate same-sex marriage want to do is broaden it. Nobody wants to change it. Nobody's going to take your wife away from you. Oh, my God. What a homophobe. He was asked one time whether he supported civil unions or domestic partnerships or same-sex marriage contracts, and he answered, quote, "I support full equal rights for everyone in America. I only oppose a redefinition of marriage." He went on to say that he's opposed to gay marriage the same way he is opposed to a brother and sister marrying. Of course, that would be incest. Or a man marrying a child. Of course, that would be statutory rape. Or someone having multiple spouses. Of course, that would be polygamy or polyandry. Is that how you say it? Polyandry? And when pressed about this, Warren said, yep, he considered those crimes equivalent to gay marriage. So statutory rape of a child is equivalent to people who are in committed relationships, same gender, say they've been together for, oh, I don't know, pick a number, 10 minutes or 40 years. It really doesn't make any difference, does it, huh? But people have been committed to each other for 40 years, who have been in a relationship all those years. If they want to get married, Rick Warren considers that the moral equivalent of statutory rape, incest, or polygamy. Sick son of a bitch. I hate these people. I hate these people. Rick Warren. He's the one that wrote The Purpose-Driven Life, the one... The guy down here that committed all the murders a couple years ago just got sentenced to life without parole. Snatched a woman who, what was her name, Nichols? Brian Nichols case down here. The woman said, oh, I'm just reading this book called The Purpose-Driven Life. Let's read it together. He was on Hannity and Combs on Fox News. And Sean Hannity, who is a cowardly little son of a bitch, insisted that the United States needs to take out Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Warren said he agreed. Hannity said then, am I advocating something dark, evil, or something righteous? Jesus God. Warren responded this way. Well, actually, the Bible says the evil cannot be negotiated with. It has to just be stopped. In fact, that is the legitimate role of government. The Bible says that God puts government on earth to punish evildoers, not good doers, evildoers. End quote. That is so sick. Well, that is just sick. Sick. Who does Warren think, other than Ahmadinejad, that Jesus would bomb? Who do you want to bomb, Warren, huh? Who would Jesus bomb? That's enough. That's enough. Sometimes people say, why are you an atheist? What about all these righteous men of God? Oh, yeah, okay. Well, that's not why I'm an atheist. I'm not an atheist because of asses like Rick Warren or Dobson or Falwell or the rest of these thugs. You all know about Frank Gaffney. He's the founder and president of something called the Center for Security Policy. He is a contributor, contributing editor, and a columnist. He was in the Bush crime family for a number of publications, including the Washington Times, National Review, WorldNet Daily, Jewish World Review. He is a neocon. He was also one of the signatories of the June 3rd, 1997 Statement of Principles from the Project for the New American Century. That was the one that went to Clinton right before they got him on illicit sex relations with Monica. They wanted Clinton to attack just about everybody in the Middle East, and of course Clinton said no. And shortly after that, within a few months after that, after saying no, just like what happened to Elliot Spitzer and who else? I mean, they always grab you by the gonads, don't they? Huh? It's just amazing. A little bit more on Frank Gaffney, and then I want you to hear, if you can make out what's being said, the conversation between him and Frank, or Chris Matthews.
Our pickle bush, when Georgie falls asleep.
When Georgie falls asleep, the mini disc player doesn't work. Oh, well. Frank Gaffney, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy, a right-winger of the highest order, one of the Project for the New American Century warmongers. It just goes on and on. The other night, he was on Chris Matthews, MSNBC, on Hardball, as was David Korn. Chris Matthews and David Korn and Frank Gaffney. David Korn, late of the Nation magazine, of course. Gaffney was one of the architects of the Iraq invasion. He is a coward, he's a lying son of a bitch, and he's a war criminal. And see if you can hear this. This runs a little over 2 minutes. See if you can get any sense out of this at all, except at the very end, where Frank Gaffney says the 4,000 Americans who have died in Iraq had to die.
Well, let me ask you, Frank, does it bother you that the American people now overwhelmingly, by about a three-quarters vote, now believe that the war was wrong, it wasn't justified?
Of course.
And now it seems
them.
Like their instincts seem to be correct, and their wisdom, based upon this information we have now, that the case made for war was really dishonest. That the real reason for it was not that we believed that we were fighting the war because of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We were against the war because we didn't like the other guy, and we wanted to get him out of power. That was the real reason.
No, the real reason was we thought he constituted a mortal threat to the American people, and proactive action was necessary.
States. A mortal threat.
And I think
you still use this strategic language. You believe
that
a mortal threat to the United States. An existential, a strategic threat to the United States. No. This guy over in Iraq is still a threat to the United States. Where do you get this from? We can't find the weapons, we can't find the rationale.
Chris,
well,
they could
kind
be
a mortal threat. What do you mean? Where do you get these words from? Mortal threat.
You kill American people. You kill American people, that's a mortal threat to the people you're killing.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's existential.
Let's go with the other words. What about the mushroom
cloud? If you know anything about biological agents, you know that they can inflict incalculable damage.
Let me tell you, you guys sold the war as a nuclear threat to the United States. A nuclear weapon was going to be delivered by a nuclear delivery device. It was going to be a vehicle. It was going to take the weapon and drop it here. You sold every trick you could to get us in this war, and now you're backpedaling. And I do find it astounding. The Vice President of the United States is admitting, well, that's how I feel, Frank.
Yeah, but let me just tell you, I think
4,000 people are dead because the way you feel.
There are 4,000 people dead.
You're wrong about this because you don't even seem to care that your facts were wrong.
Chris, there are 4,000 people.
You admit your facts were wrong and it doesn't even bother you.
May I state my position rather than you state it for me, Chris? May I do that?
No, you...
My position is it is regrettable that any Americans died. It is regrettable that they had to die, but I believe they did have to die. The threat we did know about was the chemical capability that Saddam Hussein had used against his own people. The potential for biological agents were real. There was evidence that there was an ongoing nuclear program. We had been surprised at how far advanced it was before. The danger was inaction could have resulted in the death of a great many more Americans than 4,000. It's very important that we did what we did.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Saddam Hussein using gas canisters provided by the Reagan administration, specifically by our former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and that was 20 years ago. And Gaffney has the, I can't think of a word, has the blank to sit there and say that 4,000 Americans needed to die. You goddamn bastard. You goddamn bastard, you. 4,000 Americans needed to die. So that you punks, you slimy, filthy punks, could play your games in the Middle East. Gaffney, why don't you take a weapon and go to the Middle East? Go there. Go to Iraq, you disgusting, contemptible bastard. Now remember, this is one of the guys who signed on the off on the project for a new American century that said to Clinton, invade Iran, invade Iraq, invade Afghanistan, invade Syria, invade Jordan. And Clinton said no. And within months, he was caught in a perjury trap and impeached. Frank Gaffney, did you see that bit? It's up at YouTube. It's up at Democratic Underground. It's all over the place. Watch this snake, this filthy, disgusting man, Frank Gaffney, who said that 4,000 Americans needed to die. Now, if you're the parent of one of those Americans or the spouse of one of those Americans, do you suppose they agree with that? You filthy bastard. There is nobody in the Bush administration with any honor. No ethics. And every one of them is totally amoral.
The eyes of the world.
the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Now, I think it was last night or the night before, Keith Olbermann talked with George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley about Cheney's admission of war crimes. You heard a little bit of Rachel Maddow's program. Hopefully you watched the whole thing. You can always have us on in the background. And we carried some of her program live where she's talking with Michigan Senator Carl Levin and talk about an investigation regarding the obvious crimes, Jesus Christ, that Bush and Cheney have committed. And Levin just shocked, I tell you, at Cheney's admission that he was instrumental in setting up torture cubicles. I mean, it's astonishing. But Cheney knows the fix is in. He knows nothing's going to happen, at least not in this country. But anyway, Olbermann played a clip of that recent Cheney interview on ABC in which he admitted to legally authorizing torture, which is a war crime. Here's a clip from the ABC interview introduced by Keith Olbermann.
And an even greater admission from the vice president in that interview with ABC. He also seems to have confessed to a war crime. Mr. Cheney not only defending the tactics used against terror suspect Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, including waterboarding, but also coming close to admitting he authorized them.
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in effect, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do. And they talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do, and I supported it.
Oh, did you really? Olbermann then spoke with Jonathan Turley about this admission to war crimes, and Olbermann asked why no one in the media or in the government was paying any attention to this astonishing development.
Did Dick Cheney just confess to a war crime?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? It's like that type of Zen question. If someone commits a crime and everyone's around to see it and does nothing, is it still a crime? And I think that's really the argument of this administration. It can't be a crime because no one's prosecuted us for it. But it most certainly is a crime to participate, to create, to, in many ways, monitor a torture program. So you have the vice president sitting there saying, yeah, we talked about it. They came to me. I supported it, and I helped put it through. The only problem is what he is describing is most certainly and unambiguously a war crime.
Most certainly, unambiguously, a war crime. Olbermann then asked Jonathan Turley what happens if the Obama administration does nothing about Cheney's admitted war crimes.
What happens if the next administration does not press this? Do we let, you know, the International Court at The Hague come in and take over all of our responsibilities for policing our own act here? Or where does this go domestically if he's made such a statement?
Frankly, Keith, that's what worries me the most. Is that you can't talk about change without having some moral component to it. It's not just about creating jobs or lowering the price of gasoline. What occurred in the last 8 years was an assault on who we are. And I think that President-elect Obama is going to have to decide whether he wants power without principle or whether he wants to start with a true change, to say that no matter where an investigation will take us, if there are crimes to be found, they will be prosecuted. Now, right now, many leaders in Congress are trying to create a new commission that is designed to avoid any criminal prosecution, and those leaders happen to be Democratic leaders. But it will ultimately depend on citizens and whether they will remain silent in the face of a crime that's been committed in plain view.
Now, Turley seems to be contradicting what Levin said tonight. Levin, on Rachel Maddow's program, talking about forming a commission to find out if crimes were committed. And Turley seems to feel that this Democratic leadership-led commission would be designed to avoid prosecution. Given the record of breathtakingly atrocious acts committed in this country and around the globe by our people, and the subsequent so-called investigations, I tend to lean towards what Turley is saying, another cover-up in the making. Turley then continued to speak about how the American people have to stand up and demand that the Bush crime family be held accountable for these crimes.
It's not the law that's in question here. The question is the politics, and most importantly, whether the citizens of this country will understand that they can't simply treat Cheney like some Darth Vader who controls their very thoughts and actions. It is equally immoral to stand silent in the face of a war crime and do nothing. And that is what the citizens are doing. There's this gigantic yawn as we hear about a war crime on national television being discussed matter-of-factly by the vice president. And by the way, Keith, there was a hearing not that long ago, which was equally shocking, with an administration official sort of casually comparing different types of waterboarding, like the stuff that Pol Pot used as opposed to the Spanish Inquisition. And I stood there in disbelief that in Congress we were having this rather pleasant conversation about American-style waterboarding.
So, you know, once again, we have someone trying to point out the moral imperative here, Turley, trying to point out the absolute moral imperative that comes into play if a society is going to claim that they are a society of law, a society of justice, a society that has a moral core. In our twisted case, a society based on Judeo-Christian principles. And this is a theme, of course, that we have beaten to death on this program. The fact that we don't seem to pay any attention. Standing silent while war crimes are being committed. Isn't this what the trials at Nuremberg were about to a greater or lesser degree? The crimes against humanity committed by the Nazi high command and the German industrialists was certainly why everyone was on trial. Mass murder, genocide, so on and so on. The very things that Bush and Cheney and the Bush crime family are responsible for without the death camps. The Bush crime family didn't round people up and send them to be gassed and burned. What the Bush crime family did was just indiscriminately bomb and kill and maim. But wasn't it determined at Nuremberg, at that series of trials that went on for a couple of years before the guilty verdicts, and people were hanged, people were executed, Nazis, German industrialists, for what they had done? And isn't the Jewish cri de coeur never again? And yet here we are. Here we are. And you and I and the American public, I'm not singling you out. I don't mean you. The American public, we're not screaming and demanding. We allowed Nancy Pelosi to take impeachment off the table. Are we going to allow Barack Obama to not pursue these evil, degenerate sons of bitches who have done this to us? George writes, Mike, I'm sure you know that Robert Jackson, an associate justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, was the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. This is a small part of his closing statement near the conclusion of the trials, assuming, and that's a stretch now, that the U.S. still abides by the Nuremberg principles. What's going to happen to Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, Wolfowitz, and the rest of them regarding torture and wars of aggression if we still actually believe in principles that we established in 1946? I wonder what kind of reaction there would be if this showed up on the front page of something somewhere. Here it is, Robert Jackson, 1946, a small portion of his closing statement, quote, "In conspiracy, we do not punish one man for another man's crime. We seek to punish each for his own crime of joining a common criminal plan in which others also participated. The measure of the criminality of the plan, and therefore of the guilt of each participant, is, of course, the sum total of crimes committed by all in executing the plan. But the gist of the offense in participation in the formulation or execution of the plan, but the gist of the offense is participation in the formulation or execution of the plan. These are rules which every society has found necessary in order to reach men like these defendants, pointing to the Nazis, who never shed blood on their own hands, but who lay plans that result in the shedding of blood. All over Germany today, in every zone of occupation, little men who carried out these criminal policies under orders are being convicted and punished. It would present a vast and unforgivable caricature of justice if the men who planned these policies and directed these little men should escape all penalty. Now, the line in there, and that's the end of the quote. The gist of the offense is participation in the formulation or execution of the plan. Isn't that what Cheney just said he did? God damn it, by our definition, Cheney is a war criminal. What are we going to do?
Nighty night, truth seekers. Time to snuggle up with your favorite screamer. More Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. We're going to take some calls right after the break here at the top of the hour. So if you're online, we'll be coming to you in a moment. One more thing about Rick Warren and what he is capable of causing. Their editorial in today's New York Times, editorial note about a lynching in Brooklyn, and it's about the murder of Jose Sucuz Hanye, an Ecuadorian immigrant who died over the weekend at a hospital in Queens. Now, this is the second recent killing of an Ecuadorian in the New York area. In November, Marcelo Lucero was stabbed and beaten in Pachogue. Somebody corrected that for me. Pachogue, Long Island, by a group of teenagers who the police say had been roaming the streets looking, you know, white teenagers looking to beat up a Mexican. As a matter of fact, I think one of the beaters was had a Latino name, Mexican or Hispanic name. But anyway, this latest case is just mind-boggling. Jose and his brother Romel. Jose is the one who was beaten to death. Were apparently misidentified as gay as they walked home. They had their arms around each other. They're brothers. They had their arms around each other. Which, this is one of the few cultures on Earth where men putting their arms or their hands around each other is seen as, oh, he must be queer, kill him! In the Bushwick section of Brooklyn, pre-dawn morning, they were coming home from work, their arms around each other. The brother, Romel, managed to escape the three men who jumped out of a car. They had baseball bats, started screaming anti-gay and anti-Latino epithets at these men. Jose, the one who was murdered, was struck in the head, then kicked and beaten into unconsciousness. Taken to the hospital, he was declared brain dead, died last Friday. One day before his mother, who was traveling from Ecuador, could reach him. Now, Jose Sucuz Hanye, if I'm pronouncing his name right, had come to this country a decade ago. He'd been here for 10 years. He'd been living the immigrant dream. He started out as a waiter. He eventually bought several buildings, became co-owner of a real estate agency in Bushwick, Brooklyn. He cared for his community. He gave back. He was well-liked. And so far, New York City police have arrested nobody in his murder. This is a lynching in the heart of New York City. And it's people like Rick Warren who promote this. It's people like every single one of these Christian preachers, whether they're Protestant or Catholic, is totally immaterial, who directly, indirectly, subtly, not so subtly, declare that people who are gay are not to be afforded equal protection under the law. It may be gay marriage, it may be, well, we don't need hate crimes about queers, whatever it is. So Rick Warren has another death on his hands. We just talked about conspiracy. I just quoted for you Robert Jackson, the chief prosecutor. It doesn't make any difference if it's Cheney involved in torture or Bush involved in invading a country or Rick Warren promoting the death of gay people. It's all the goddamn same. Every bit of it. And Rick Warren, though, calls himself a pastor. And how many people go to his Saddleback Church? What, 10,000? 20,000? It's astonishing. Just astonishing. And Gaffney, it's regrettable they had to die, but I believe they did have to die. The 4,000. The danger was inaction that could have resulted in the death of a great many more Americans than 4,000. Inaction from what, you lying son of a bitch? And then he says this, and that's the reason I'm still delighted that we did what we did, that we sacrificed 4,000 Americans, 500,000, 750,000, 1,000,000 Iraqis, and this miserable ghoul. This miserable son of a bitch says he's delighted that we did what we did and that 4,000 did have to die. Now, Gaffney happens to be Jewish. Gaffney happens to know that these are the same arguments used in Germany in the 20s and 30s, and that these are the kinds of arguments that resulted in 7 million, 6 million, 10 million Jews going to the ovens and the death camps. And this son of a bitch has the nerve to say it. I'm delighted in what we did. Of course they had to die. In order to protect us from Saddam, what did Hitler say? They have to die in order to protect us from the Jew. And this guy is on television, on MSNBC, NBC, GE, one of the biggest producers of weapons of mass destruction on Earth. No offense against Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews was thoroughly pissed. But Chris Matthews' employer happens to be General Electric. But Frank Gaffney, what is that cri de coeur we were talking about, Frank? Never again? Never again! You miserable bastard.
story in your eyes. It's been shining down upon me now.
Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program on Nova M Radio. Coming to your phone calls here. As soon as I share with you our entry tonight from Prairie 2, our Bruce Enberg, our economic affairs advisor, correspondent. Prairie 2 writes, "Hey, Mike, I'm sure everybody has gotten a glimpse of those battlefield memorial services that soldiers hold where they have a row of rifles with bayonets plunged into the earth and the helmets resting on the stocks. In front is an empty pair of combat boots for each fallen comrade. Despite media censorship, these images have been seen. Do you suppose Bush can hear those thousands of empty boots marching up Pennsylvania Avenue at night? Probably not. When he hears the rain on the roof, does he imagine little tiny shoes hitting the roof, the shoes of dead Iraqi babies? When a cloud passes in front of the sun over his shoulder, does he imagine the sudden darkness is a cloud of shoes from a million dead Iraqi civilians hurling down from the sky to crush him into a smear on the sidewalk? Probably not. He's a soulless killer. How about you middle-class Republicans out there? You cheered at the shock and awe bombing on television. When all this began, did you think about the tiny shoes torn from the broken and burning bodies of children? Do you hear the footsteps of the dead children? Of course not. Iraq is a long way away, and those people aren't like you, are they? You Republicans don't care that a modern country no longer has clean drinking water. Sewage runs in the street through the piles of garbage. The electricity rarely works. Medical care is non-existent. People disappear. Millions are refugees and on and on. Doesn't matter to you. But while you were being scared of terrorists that didn't exist, the Bush crime family stole everything. Our country, too. Not just Iraq. If that liberal blank, 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 well, you know, call him what you want. If that liberal doesn't fix the economy, you Republican morons helped the Bush crime family to destroy, this country will look a lot like Iraq, much faster than you can imagine. Is that pair of shoes that you're wearing comfortable? They might have to last you. Prairie 2. Yeah, since shoes are all the rage in the news right now, shoes here, shoes there, shoes everywhere. All right, the phone number here is 800-989-1480, and we have a bunch of open lines. So let's get some phone calls in here. I want to hear what you got to say. Oh, my goodness, look who's on the phone. It's Victor Lopez.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Hey, good to hear from you. Congratulations on winning the essay, the Nation essay for college students. My God, I was
a little surprised. I was a little surprised at that. You know, the other finalists were from Yale and Middlebury, and I thought, I didn't think I stood a chance.
Yeah, well, guess what? You stood a chance and you won. I just really applaud that that effort by you, Victor. That's the greatest. I think you've shown the greatest comeback since Lazarus.
Only if I believe in the Bible. Only.
I remember when you first wrote to me and first started. How old were you?
I was pretty young. I think I was just 21, Mike.
Oh, you were 21.
Yeah, maybe.
I thought you were like
younger. I was a lot younger, maybe 19.
I thought you were 19 when you first started writing. When you were in the Miami Detention Center, remember?
Yeah, I was definitely 19, 20. Yeah, I was definitely younger. Doesn't that seem like a lifetime ago?
Oh my God! Oh my God! In a sense, for a lot of people, it was a lifetime.
Yeah.
And when I was telling your story last night, I don't know if I got it right. You were serving time in Miami Detention Center, and they sent you to the Virgins.
Yeah, sort of against my will. I had a really lousy counsel in the islands there, and they kind of just what ended up happening was they were housing me in the main in the stateside pending everything because of the violence in the islands jail.
Right. Oh, that's right. You had requested to be sent.
Begged.
to Miami. Right. Okay, I got
it. Yeah.
But then they sent you back.
They sent me back, and that really scared me. I think that was one of the last letters that I wrote you. I didn't know where, you know, when they threw me on a plane. And I think that's when it was really crunch time, because we had no idea what was going on. I remember one of the last things I asked was that you write the judge, because I just didn't know what was going to go on.
Oh, that, well, yeah, but that, and that was the judge in Miami, which I did. But you and I, you wrote to me way beyond that.
Well, way beyond that, yeah.
Right.
And, but I mean, like, before the transfer, I wrote you. I was scared. No, actually, that was quite a bit before.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I moved, I still sat there for well over a year before they came to a decision. And when they originally made the decision, it was a monstrous sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And it took even, I think, another year after that to get it corrected.
Right, right.
And it was a lot of sitting.
And now you're out. The one thing that impressed me about you from day one was that you never tried to avoid responsibility for what put you in jail to begin with. I, over the course of doing radio, I've gotten letters before from people who, you know, just swear they're innocent, and a good number of them are. Don't misunderstand.
Well,
an awful lot of innocent people in jail. You and I both know that.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a lot of people backed into things. Like for instance, me. I mean, I made a mistake. You know, I made a mistake, and I couldn't argue with the fact I made a mistake. It wasn't as blatant or intentional as what it was made out to be by the prosecution. But you know, what can you do? And you know, I had to say something. I was listening to your podcast last night after I got back home, and you know, there was moments during that time when you were my only friend, and it was like the world was against me. My family is pretty much I had grown up in foster care, and after that adopted, and my adopted parents were killed in a car accident. So basically I was alone.
Right.
And, you know, you were one of the, you were like a voice, you know, and it wasn't like an everyday thing, but, you know, here I was writing you, and, you know, I'm sure you get a lot of letters, and you were one of my only friends. It sounds weird, you know, it sounds...
Well, no, I can understand that. There was definitely a connection between you and me when you told me about how the prisoners would sit around a Miami detention center and clap and yell and scream.
Oh, you'd hear it at nighttime. I mean, you would make a cut, and you know, you were quoted. I mean...
Well, you know, when you wrote that, Victor, that kind of hooked me. You know, it's like, oh, really? Talk about a captive audience.
And there's also guards. And I mean, you know, we would talk. I mean, it was, you know, Miami had never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and it was highly talked about. And then I asked you had mentioned me on the radio. You know, I was an instant, you know, celebrity in there.
Yeah. Well, enough about me. How are you doing? How's school going? What?
I've been working. You know, Elaine pushes me really hard.
That's your stepmom.
Yeah, that's mom. And I should say they got everything sealed.
Not stepmom, your adopted mother.
Adopted mom,
right,
yeah.
Right. She's
and they
your
got
mother,
everything.
Right.
And she is mom, let me tell you. But but she said she's trying to undo 26 years of, you know, like I like cereal before I like cooked food, things like that. But, you know, we got the entire record sealed and expunged, so it's no longer exists. Which means I can get jobs in different places that I never, you know, that most people couldn't, you know, in the same situation.
You got it considered under first offender. Is that what it's called?
It's they just basically brought up the whole case, gave it time served, and closed it, sealed it from the public's eye, and then expunged it from the public record. So it was a federal judge that did that.
Mm-hmm.
So. It was because of the First Offenders Act, but it was also because the case was just it would be too much for me to get into. But the case was procedurally incorrect. They had me moved all over the country, and then you know there was a lot of incorrect things that when the new judge came in, he just corrected everything. But it took 5 years. You know,
when I read the first paragraph or two of your Nation essay about what it was like when you were a kid, you know, I come from a pretty weird. Background, I left home when I was 16. I had to get away from the violence, but not like you. Well, I think not like the stuff that you went through. Jesus God, Victor.
Well,
you know, that's one of the reasons I really have, and I mean this sincerely, and you know, because I don't BS, you know that. But I have great respect for you. The fact that you have done what you've done, you know, Elaine has helped immensely. But you are the one who at some point made your decision that. Maybe you made it several times, but I stand in complete awe of your ability to turn things around and come back, pal. I mean that.
Well, Mike, you know, it's not. There's nights that I question. You know, I mean, I wish there was a way I could rewind the past.
Oh yeah, don't worry.
I mean, you know, but you know, I've been struggling. It's so funny. I've been struggling with my own personal things. You know, just doubting what I'm doing. I mean, I'm doing well in school. I mean, I'm doing really well. I have straight A's. I had this incorrigible English professor that she was hating. I mean, she just was on me the whole time, but I think I did well. I mean, but there's times I have flashbacks and I have a lot of memories, and it can weigh down my entire week.
Oh, yeah. Oh God, I can only imagine. Victor, let me do a break. Stay there. Let me do a break and come back. I'm going to chat just a little bit longer, okay?
No problem.
All right, let me put you on hold. We'll come back. We're talking with Victor Lopez. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
The radio.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malloy, only on Nova M Radio.
23 past the hour. Victor Lopez, the Nation Magazine's college essay winner for this year, has called in. I guess that's a good way to introduce you.
It's a much better way to do
it. Now, you were talking about... and I'm sure this is a case, having good days and bad days, flashbacks. Are you talking about prison flashbacks or family, lack of family or foster care? What?
I mean, I think a bit of it all. I mean, around the Christmas season, the parents I was adopted by were killed in November. Mm. And Elaine's family, miraculously, they're all very successful but down to earth, Jewish converted Quaker. And that's a heck of a conversion. But her mother, her brother, we were up in Philadelphia for Thanksgiving, and they've just—they've accepted me like no other have. And they just ask one thing that I do right, that I keep on going. And they don't really push me in any direction. So let me go. You know, I make mistakes. You know, I make mistakes—not huge mistakes, but you know, yeah. I make mistakes. And but every now and then when I go to bed, it seems like I'm lonely. And I just remember the past sometimes. You just can't escape the past, you know.
No, you can't.
And it does. It makes me, you know, I've been in a crowd of people, you know, at my college or whatever, and sometimes I just feel sad. And I cope with it. You know, I don't know how. I asked Elaine why things just come in stride to me, and she said, well, because ever since birth, I've sort of just dealt with blows. So I asked her why the 5 years of experience, 5-6 years of experience, didn't debilitate me, and she said, well, by that time, you're already used to it.
Plus, so. Do you think it also hardened, it let you develop a shell to protect yourself? The problem with developing those shells... and trust me, I know about this. I did like 13, 14 years of therapy, Victor. But the problem with developing those shells is that they keep everything out. They keep out, you know, it's a way of defending yourself against the pain and the rage and the sadness, but it also keeps out the good stuff. I know you're going to work this part out. You've got a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff to sort through.
I do it day by day. You know, I am running. I mean, I have to say though, Mike, at that point when you asked everyone to write me, I was at my lowest point. I was holding on by the thinnest thread that was ever spun. I was about out of it, and people just started writing and involved themselves and, you know, in my everyday life. And a lot of those people I still talk to now, not as much as I would like to, because, you know,
you have a life. Yeah.
Yeah. And not that they didn't have one when they were writing me, you know, but it just seems like I'm just trying to categorize everything and I have a bad organization problem.
I just want
to do everything at once. And, but I'm really thankful for that, because, they've just pushed me to be a better person, every day, and they made me feel, you know, they lifted me up, and, can you imagine that feeling, Mike, to be just sort of alone, and all of a sudden I had, you know, so many acquaintances, friends, people interested, that it made me, you know, I could step through that day even better. Mm-hmm. And even on my bad days now, I think about things. And I mean, even you, and thank God, now I can email you. You know, if I have like a question or concern, I can always email you.
All right, listen, Victor, we're out of time. You're going to make it, pal. You're going to do good. And send me an email. I'll send you my home phone number. And if you ever want to talk, give me a call. All right?
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Mike.
All right, we love you, Victor.
Love you too.
All right, man.
For Radical Talk Radio, make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
Welcome back. It's 26:25 before the hour. All right, let's do some phone calls. Some more phone calls, starting with Rob, who's calling from Mount Iron, Minnesota. Hey, Rob.
Good evening, Mike Malloy.
How you doing?
I am doing really great, and the whole thing is where you are such a great person. I can't hardly believe it. After listening to Victor, it's where you got my blood boiling with your whole program all the way up until 10 o'clock. But after listening to him, it's where the one thing that he didn't say that I feel and he feels is thank you.
Yeah, well, sure. But remember, all I did was put his name and address up on my website.
Yeah, but you let him vent for all that time. And there were all these things that were involved in this whole situation. And the whole, you know, I mean, you know, it means a really lot to him, you know.
Well, you know, somebody wrote to me today, listening to what I had to say about Victor the other night before he called in, and this person wrote and said, you know, with all the, I'm paraphrasing, she didn't really say this, but what she meant was, with all the crap and the garbage out there, to hear something like that story about this kid who. Well, he's not a kid anymore. He's, you know, he's an adult man now. But this kid at the time who goes through what he went through, writes an essay, enters a contest for the nation, and wins the damn thing, is studying to be a journalist. Getting straight A's in school. I mean, when you hear stuff like that, it's just like wow.
But at the same time, you know, I mean, with all the people that are out there, you know, for you to take an interest in it, it's where it means an awful lot to him, and the whole thing is it means a lot to me, too, because it's where, you know, here are these people out there that might have failed, but at the same time, just a little encouragement by you could have gone a long way, you know?
Well, I appreciate it, but the real reason you called, Rob.
Okay, fine. I want to get down to
let's get back to the ugly stuff.
Can we go down to the dirty basics? It's where
yeah, the dirty, rotten stuff.
Okay, fine. The real world, Bush 3, Bush 2, Bush 1.
Yeah, yeah.
Bush 3, George W. has ruined the economy. Bush 2 tried to ruin the economy. Bush 1 was involved with the Weimar Germany, right?
Well, beyond that, with the Nazis, and don't forget, there's Bush 4 coming. That's Jeb, who now the rumors are he's going to run for the Senate from Florida. So watch out for Bush 4.
Yeah, but the one thing we got to be all think about right now is guess what?
What?
If we really want to be able to take and be a conservative mind, 57 million people wanted to be able to have McCain in office, right?
Right.
How many people have been fooled by this philosophy?
What philosophy?
The conservative philosophy, Bush philosophy.
How many people have been fooled? All of us.
All of us?
Well, no, I don't mean all of us have been fooled, but all of us have suffered.
I mean, I'm only talking about the last vote. I mean, there was 57 million people that voted for McCain.
Right.
And he was trying to be able to do the same thing that Bush did, didn't he?
Well, he did when he was a senator. He kept claiming he was he wasn't Bush. You know, trust me, I'm not Bush. Yada yada yada. So, but
you know, Doofy continued. You know, I mean, when you really come right down to it, it's where right now we're not in really good shape as far as the economy, are we?
We're not in good shape in terms of anything. They really have, they being the Bush crime family, Rob.
I mean, when you really come right down to it, there's still 57 million people out there that still believe that this is the way that America should go.
I don't understand that. I'll never understand that. How people can continue to vote against their own best interests. But you're right. 57 million did that. Oh, we lost him. All right, Rob. Thanks anyway. I appreciate you checking in, pal. Al is calling from Wilmington, North Carolina, listening on the internet. Hey, Al, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey, Mike.
How are you?
I'm all right. How you doing?
Good. I'm fine.
Well, good. I spoke to you about 3 years ago from Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, I remember it like it was yesterday.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
Right.
So I was feeling pretty low then, and it's been quite an odyssey since then. I grew up in North Carolina, and for one reason or another, found my way back here and relocated.
Uh-huh.
When I was living in South Florida, you know, you get that criticism of Cubans who are fighting Castro from the U.S. instead of fighting Castro from Cuba.
Right.
And I kind of felt that way about, or at least I came to feel that way about fighting the Jesse Helms of North Carolina, that type,
mm-hmm.
from South Florida instead of North Carolina.
Hear you. Yeah, I hear you.
So when I came back here, I thought, well, you know what? It's an election year. And I can do what I can do, try to do what I can to turn this state blue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got involved with the local Democratic Party.
Well, it looks like you succeeded, too.
Well, in a manner of speaking.
Well, you turned it blue.
Well, we cut Bush's margin by 3/4 in this county, which is saying a lot
mm-hmm.
in southeastern North Carolina.
Oh, I know. I used to live in Raleigh.
Oh, well, Raleigh is flat-out progressive compared
well,
to here.
Well, it is now, but when I lived there, just outside of Raleigh and Cary or some of those little towns right outside Raleigh, used to have great big billboards that
KKK.
Said...
KKK.
Yeah, so this is Klan country. You remember that.
Oh, yeah.
So it may be progressive now, but I know what you're talking about southeast North Carolina. Woo, Lord.
Yeah, so that's where I am. I even became a precinct chair.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a Kucinich type.
Right.
And I was thinking maybe at least Edward stood a chance, because towards the end there he was really saying some of the stuff I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Then he dropped out, and so I really didn't have some choices that I preferred.
Mm-hmm.
And I started hearing things about Obama, about what he favored in mm-hmm. terms of doing the religion bit better than the Bushes, like the faith-based initiative programs, mm-hmm. for instance.
Right.
And the Democratic Party having all kinds of faith-based outreach
right.
programs
mm-hmm.
to the religious right. And it got to where I really could not follow through with what my intent was for going out and aggressively campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I compensated by working for local candidates and letting the other chips fall where they might.
Well, that, you know, I'll tell you something, Al. You're not alone. I had the same situation in making my decisions about Barack Obama. The only thing that I'm counting on, and I've said this several times, and you may feel the same way, Al, and that is whatever he had to do to get elected. You know, he didn't really whore himself or prostitute himself the way, say, no offense to sex workers, the way McCain was doing. And like a lot of, like George W. Bush did, like Bill Clinton did when he was running for office. Barack Obama didn't do that. And what I'm hoping is that he is drawing in all of these crazy right-wingers, Republicans, these religious nutcases, drawing them in, and he is going to, it's going to be like a rope-a-dope situation where he's going to pull them in, and they think that they are winning, and in the last moment, so to speak, you know, metaphorically speaking, Obama will turn them around rather than they're turning him around. Now, that may be all nonsense. It may be my way of holding on by my fingernails, hoping that Barack Obama turns out to be progressive. He may not be. He may be a DLC Democrat. He may be, you know, I, at this point, I don't know. But I'm doing this to stave off the panic, because I feel the same thing that you and a lot of Democrats, well, not Democrats, but a lot of liberals, a lot of progressives have felt. Like, uh-oh. But given the choice back on November 4th, I would do it again. Because the thought of a McCain-Palin regime or any kind of continued Republican domination, I couldn't handle. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
You know the neocons have told you lies. When they get caught, they give you 2 cents out of five. They don't worry about what makes you cry. Your child's in a riot. Are they gonna die? Gasoline's in short supply. ExxonMobil is barely getting by. With millions in profits, it's...
He's in the jailhouse now.
No, he's out.
He's in the jailhouse now.
It's about 10 before the hour. Thanks to our crew, Ian Huff, who engineered, who also answered your calls tonight. Ben Birch, our technical advisor. Sharon Gordy, our military affairs correspondent. Bridget Wolf and Bob Alexander ethically advise this program. So blame them. Our economic advisor is Bruce Enberg, and the executive producer of this program is Catherine Bay. Back to your phone calls. Joe is calling from Miami, listening on WINZ. Hi, hey, Joe.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm all right.
You know, watching this economy, this is a culmination of Reagan, Bush 1, and Bush 2, and their philosophy of cutting taxes, which the average American jumps at right away, but not cutting services to match, and keeping the services up by borrowing huge amounts of foreign debt. This is a culmination where they're going to crush the middle class. This is all well planned. And I think it might be too late for Barack Obama to even save the place now. We're in such economic disaster. I don't think we're going to save the country. I think they've succeeded in breaking the whole system.
Well, you know, the system was crushed in 1929 right. and 30 and 31, and it was reinvented. You may be right. Barack Obama and his advisors and his administration may have to reinvent everything. Because we can't go back to what we've been doing, an SEC that doesn't ride herd over securities.
Let me make a point about the consumer out there. Here's what happened to him. 40% of the houses are now underwater. Well, those people owe more money in the house than what they have borrowed. Out in their driveway is a three-year-old car that has a six-year car loan on it. They haven't had a decent raise in the Bush administration since 2000.
Right.
Their savings are zero, and finally, they got $9,000 to $12,000 of personal debt on their credit card. The consumer's finished. Everybody's bankrupt out here. They don't know it.
Well, that's why I say it's going to take a reinvention of how we do business in this country, among ourselves and with the rest of the world. If we go back to the ways that have been, oh, and by the way, you left one name out of that list. Let's not forget Clinton.
Yeah, but at least Clinton didn't cut taxes. He did try to balance the budget somewhat. See, because remember, he had a Republican Congress. They're complicit.
Well, mostly, what I fault Clinton for in terms of the economy is his signing NAFTA.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
So let's not completely let him off the hook. There is all I'm saying. But what you describe, Joe, is a situation that Barack Obama is going to have to deal with. And thanks, Joe. I appreciate you checking in. He's going to have to reinvent, or I think I mean by that, start with a clean slate. We have partially nationalized banking system. We are going to have a partially nationalized auto industry. We need to go ahead and stop with the partialing. Let's go ahead and roll the dice, since predatory capitalism has reached the end of the road, and it's clear it cannot be regulated. That is so clear. When these scum develop instruments with which they decide how to make money and trade, and nobody can understand the instruments, an SEC run by Jesus wouldn't work. So it's over. The capitalist model in this country is finished. What should take its place? This should be the debate, I think, not just inside the Obama administration, but among us. I mean, goddamn it, we are not sheep. We don't have to sit back here and let our houses be repossessed, let our cars fall apart, let our 401ks be destroyed without a response. And as long as we, Joe, all 300 million of us, just sit back on our asses, not too much is going to happen. Obama has to know that he's sitting on top of a powder keg. And I'm not talking about these filthy Republicans. Screw them. I'm talking about decent Americans who've had it. This is no time for partial anything. We have got to move to democratic socialism. We have got to move to massive public works projects. We've got to move to the full nationalization of the banks in this country, the full nationalization of the stock market in this country, the full nationalization of energy and transportation and health care. It has to be done. That leaves tremendous amount of room for any entrepreneur who wants to do anything. You want to start a business? Start your business. But you're not going to start an airline or a rail system unless you take on the government as a partner. You're not going to open a bank unless you take on the government as a partner. You want to open a steel mill? Go for it. You want to open a haberdashery? Go for it. You want to farm? Go for it. Whatever you want to do. But these massive industries that over and over and over again, what does it take? How many times do we have to be hit by shoes until we realize it has become ungovernable? You cannot manage and maintain honesty in capitalism. It can't be done by its very nature. It is designed to cheat. It is designed to take without compensation. Jesus, God, why do any of us not understand that by now? Capitalism's heyday was during slavery. That's when it worked the best, unless you were a slave. It has to be changed. Now, when I heard Obama talking change during the campaign, that's what I thought he meant. It better be. It truly better be. I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.